The Human Race is proudly brought to you by Elevate. Support babies' healthy development at every stage.
The Human Race podcast discusses subjects that will be upsetting for some, including infertility, miscarriage, and stillbirth. Support is available. Check the show description for details.
Kia ora and welcome to The Human Race, a podcast about those who are in the race of their lives to create a life. My name's Nadine Higgins. I'm a broadcaster, a journalist, and for the past 4 years, I've been trying to make a baby with my husband.
That's me. I'm Dan. And we reckon infertility is lonely enough without making it a dirty little secret. So we wanted to bring you stories from those people that have been through it.
So even if you don't want to talk about it, maybe those stories can give you hope, or at the very least, make you feel a little less alone. This is a collab podcast between Stuff and Wabi Sabi Media. The fairy tales tell us you fall in love, maybe get married and start a family. Simple, romantic, easy, right? But getting pregnant can be tricky, we know, but so can meeting someone to start a family with. Jessica Jordan always knew she wanted to be a mum, but decided rather than wait and hope for the right person to come along, she'd go it alone. Hi Jessica, and welcome to The Human Race.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, our pleasure. Jessica, you decided at a young age, around 21, I think, that you wanted to be a mother no matter what. Now, why did you decide at such a young age?
I just always wanted to be a mum. So from the time that I was a toddler, like I just had this huge maternal drive and to nurture. And so I for some reason I kind of knew from sort of like 12 or 13, I was like, I want to have babies, but I think it's going to be hard. It was really weird. I don't know. And so I actually, it was a bit ridiculous. Like I started seeing baby things and buying them and like consciously making the decision to like prepare to be a mum when I was like, I think I bought my first thing when I was like 14.
It's just that maternal instinct.
Yeah, maternal drive. Yeah, maternal drive. Like I wanted to breastfeed my dolls when I was like a little toddler. Like I just very much wanted to be a mum and wanted to nurture and wanted to bring, you know, small creatures in.
Well, and then you
close.
Became a midwife,
yes.
Right? So that's very fitting with that kind of
nurturing
sure.
Maternal
mentality.
Yeah.
But at what stage do you go, okay, now? Now's when we're going to do it, and there's not a person on the scene, or was there an age you had in your head?
I had endo surgery when I was 21. Like I had a couple of surgeries 3 or 4 months apart, and yeah, basically the gynecologist said to me, as long as you kind of think about having babies by the time you're about 28, 30. And I was like, okay, well, but I think I had made the decision that it was going to be 28, that I was going to, and then I pushed it out to 30 because I just thought I'll give the universe, God, whoever, knight in shining armor, a little bit more time to turn up. But it was sort of like 28 to 30 was, yeah, if there wasn't anyone, then I was just going to crack on because I didn't want to sacrifice, like knowing that I had endometriosis and I did have a low ovarian reserve. I think initially it was 7 or 6 picomoles, which is pretty low.
Sorry, what does that mean?
So that's your anti-Mullerian hormone.
Oh, so they measure in, what did you say?
Picomoles.
Picomoles.
Yeah. Gosh.
Get the encyclopedia out. Again.
Yeah, so picomoles per litre, basically. And there's a graph and you kind of fit on it in terms of your number and your age and all that kind of thing. So 6 is pretty low.
So there were forces at play. You'd had endometriosis, your egg reserves were low, and I think you'd already also had a surgery.
Yep. I'd had 2 endo surgeries, and one was a diagnostic, and then the second one was where they actually removed the endometriosis.
But there was also maybe an injury from
when
you were young.
Yeah, so when they went in for the first surgery, it was diagnostic because that surgeon at the time didn't have advanced laparoscopic skills, but the hospital wanted to check. And she went in and she was like, oh, your right tube looks really weird. Like, I don't know, what's going on? Is that endo? You know, what is going on there? And my mum, who's obviously not a gynecologist, was like, oh, I wonder if that happened when you had surgery when you were a baby. So I had an inguinal hernia. So yeah, down low in my groin, actually on both sides, I had bilateral inguinal hernias, and they were, that was when I was 6 weeks old, and they were repaired when I was 6 months old. And basically mum was like, I think that the surgeon damaged your right tube when he did that, because it's all so close together and a 6 month old baby is so tiny.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a general surgeon and they just do the whole body, and you know, there was probably a trainee. And so then they went in to do the second surgery and they tried to flush the tubes and
couldn't.
Yeah, and took the images, and the cameras were not quite as, like, this is more than 10 years ago now, so the laparoscopic cameras were probably not quite as advanced as they are now. And, yeah, we just kind of had this theory that was just a possible theory that it had happened then. When I decided that I did want to get cracking and have a baby, I approached a private – I had health insurance by then – approached a private gynecologist who, yeah, is my best friend's husband. And he did another laparoscopy just to kind of make sure that everything was honky-dory. But by that time the cameras had advanced and he was able to just, I don't know, he maybe just looked at a different angle and he could just see exactly what had happened, like what he thought had happened. And yeah, the tube was just, had just been basically either slashed or they'd put a suture around it and just pulled, like cut the fallopian tube in half.
Wow. Mm.
So then we spent like a year or more fighting ACC to say, like, this is what happened, this is what this professor is saying has happened, fought them tooth and nail, and they agreed that the injury happened and that was what had happened. I had to meet with a psychiatrist to assess the level of my injury, and then yeah, they agreed it was covered, which meant that fertility treatment was then covered.
So you're at the point to, as you say, crack on.
Yeah.
What did your friends and family think of you going it alone, as it were?
Yeah, they were all pretty excited. Yeah, yeah.
No naysayers.
Not anyone that matters.
That's the key. That doesn't mean there aren't any. It means no one whose opinion you value.
Nobody, right? Yeah, nobody in the initial stages anyway. Nobody, like, there'll been a few little comments, especially from like slightly more conservative people. But what I decided was I wasn't going to, because my fertility was a bit compromised, I wasn't going to sacrifice a potential child.
That waiting could have meant that it just never happened.
Right. So I'm going to throw away or compromise or let go of my most fertile years. Like, we're at our most fertile right at this minute, and it only gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from, you know, lifestyle changes and stuff, but for women it's like, you know, age is your biggest thing.
Legitimately a ticking clock.
Yeah, and I had seen so many beautiful women who had never found anyone and hit menopause and just missed that opportunity, and like a lot of people – yeah, say, oh, well, you know, you just, the person's going to come along. Like, actually, for some people, he or she does not come along.
People can be quite judgy about that too. They're like, oh, is she too fussy? Are his standards too high? I'm like, if you're going to spend the rest of your life with somebody, I think your standards should be high, you know?
Or that right person comes along, but just a little bit later in life. And then, as you say, you've missed the window those years. So it sounds like you've got this great supportive group of whānau and friends around you now, and it's time you've decided to go for it. How do you find a donor?
That was the thing. So I was told that the waiting list, I think I'm actually still on the waiting list.
I've heard that story so many times. They go on the waiting list and you never hear from them again.
Yeah. I think I am. Unless they've taken me off the waiting list without my consent, that's fine. I got a baby.
Sorry, it's just like a government waiting list.
Yeah. So that's a government waiting list. But like different clinics, there's a few different clinics around the country. Like obviously there's the main Fertility Associates. But then within, say, in Auckland and I think in Wellington, there are other fertility clinics being run. Auckland Hospital has their own fertility clinic. Mm. So there's waiting lists. There's sperm and egg donors that are signed up to a particular clinic. And yeah, so I'm on the waiting list at Fertility Associates in Hamilton, and I was told it would could be up to 3 years. And I think I had talked with someone who had was also on the waiting list, and they'd already been on for 2 years at that point and were still waiting. So I was like, right, we need to find a solution. Yeah. A friend had offered me her husband's sperm.
Was he in on that?
Yeah, did he get the heads up on this?
I wasn't aware of the first initial conversation, but I was like, awesome. I approached her a year later and he'd since had a vasectomy.
Oh, okay.
No, but hard to get the goods out then. Yeah.
So, yeah, and in the meantime, she had told me about this forum called NZ Surrogacy that connects intended parents with donors and egg donors and sperm donors and embryo donors, and not necessary to surrogates, but that's what it was called. But basically I joined the forum and I posted a classified, and in the meantime she approached her best friend as well, and was like, hey, I offered our sperm to Jessica, but he said it was sick to me, so and I posted on this forum, but Stuart, our donor, was a moderator on the forum. So he saw that. He got the message from Alison.
Oh, so it came through two angles.
Yeah, and he was like, so when people ask me, I'm like, it's kind of complex.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically then he sent me a Facebook message and was like, hey, look, I would really like to help you to have a family. So that was amazing. And he actually already had made some deposits at Fertility Associates, which is another kind of story. He was going to donate to someone and then they ended up finding a partner, so they went down their own route.
So we've got some of Stuart's stuff on ice.
Yes.
Now, do you go straight into? I'm going to throw a couple of acronyms at you.
Yes. Yeah.
You go IVF or DIY to start?
So we did both.
Okay.
Yeah. So we did both. So there was a little bit of a waiting list. So I didn't need to wait for when you use a donor sperm, it's got to go through a quarantine
kind of freezing process. Period,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah. But it didn't need to do that because it had already done it, but my IVF ticket hadn't come up yet. So there was a bit of a waiting list there. And I think I waited 18 months.
There's always so much waiting in this process.
It's like literally the theme of it is like, hurry up and wait. Hurry up and wait and just like get all the things you need.
Oh, and here's another curveball,
Yeah. We really need you to come in and see the fertility clinic, but she doesn't have an appointment for 3 months. So just ridiculous. No, mine was actually really great, but I know some doctors you're not able to get in with very easily. So yeah, we had the waiting list and I thought, I just want to try. By that time I knew the surgeon had seen that the one tube was damaged and the other one was now subsequently blocked with endo for whatever reason. So I had like basically what we thought was kind of no chance of conceiving naturally. But there were a few little things that made me think, maybe it's worth having a hoon. So we...
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there were a few things that meant that, like, okay, do you know what? I'm going to give it a go. So we did home inseminations. We did I can't actually remember how many, but I think we did 5 or 6. So basically, mum also thinks this is one of the hilarious parts of it, was so I got some kit. I managed to acquire some kit, which was just stuff that wasn't necessarily meant for home insemination, but I was like, that'll be really good.
So can I ask what kind of kit?
Oh, so basically a long tube catheter type tube, but with a little bit of rigidity so that I could use a colleague who I had taught everything she knew about a particular procedure that I do as a midwife. I knew that she would be able to basically do IUI.
So not just
intracervical
or
intravaginal. No, yep. It was like full on IUI.
And so that's where you actually put it into the uterus.
Which is actually not recommended to do that with unwashed sperm because it can introduce all kinds of whatever. But I was very trusting of my donor and you can also have cervical shock and stuff like that. But I didn't. I'm a tough nut. So I was like, we are doing this. So yeah, basically, yeah, 6 months. They weren't all consecutive because we had to take breaks a few times with a few different things. And yeah, we did this home IUI. So we organized that he would come over you know, he would be at home, at his home, and he would produce a sample because he didn't want to produce a sample in my house. He thought it would just not be
easy. Psych him out a little bit.
Yeah. And then, yeah, he'd produce a sample at home, then he would scoot over to ours with a cup between his legs or in his pocket or
keeping it warm.
Between his boobs, yeah. Yeah, keeping it warm. And then, yeah, and bring it in. And then my friend, yeah, would be there and we would, yeah, do the business with
– Okay, so obviously that didn't – you gave it a good nudge.
Yeah.
Didn't quite work.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, as you say, it's all a bit of a blur now, but yes. You did multiple rounds of IVF, right?
Yes. Well, I did four. Yeah. I remember all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Egg collections during lockdown.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. So it was a lot, but I think there's a real – like everybody's got a bit of a tapestry. Well, not a bit. Like everybody has a tapestry of their life, of what makes up – yeah, their journey of humanness. And so we dived into the first cycle in December of 2019. It was we made one embryo. So I got six eggs and made one embryo, put it back fresh, and it didn't stick. And at that time, my dad was going through getting a diagnosis of cancer. And so it was really
so much going on all at once.
Because I was like, Dad, do you think I need to – just wait? Like, do you think we need to wait and just focus on your
health?
And he was like, no, you just focus on your process. I'll be fine. It was so lovely of him. And that was, yeah, like that told me how much he really supported me in my journey. Subsequently, he got really very sick very quickly, and the cancer was metastatic, and which means it spread through the whole body without kind of us realizing, and he got really sick. So I had the treatment in December 2019, and then he was diagnosed that month, and then February 2020, just like 3 months later, he died.
Oh, gosh,
and so that was like the most devastating, awful, horrific thing that I have ever gone through, and that was such a contrast to me with the fertility journey, because the fertility for me feels like new hope and new life and the opportunity to create new people and new generations and his whakapapa and his name and his life living on. And I was just really excited about it. I was really excited about it and super positive because I had this contrast of like horrible, awful death, like of just awful grief. And then this beautiful opportunity. And
yeah,
so
was, something to focus
yeah,
on.
So I was positive about it. And that's what I mean about the tapestry of it, because that was like the first thread. And it was like the first cycle, we got one embryo, it didn't stick. Dad got sick, Dad died. And then I was able to go straight back and straight into my next, not straight into, but about 4 months later, into my next funded, government funded cycle. So we started that 6 weeks after my dad died, and I was really positive. I was like, yep, cool. I knew it wasn't going to work the first time. I just felt it wasn't going to work the first time, but this is going to be the one. And then we went into COVID lockdown.
Of course we did, yeah.
But nobody knew how COVID would affect embryos or pregnancy or anything like that. So there was just radio silence across the fertility community in terms of like people. I had started my cycle. I was injecting myself with like thousands of dollars worth of drugs. Like granted, not my money, but also like it is a lot of money and it's a lot.
And it has an impact on your body.
Exactly.
It's not nothing. Yeah.
So there was like no word about whether we were going to continue. But we did, but we went into lockdown and I, yeah, caught an Uber to my egg collection.
Oh, so you had to go through that process all alone.
Yeah, I did. But it was okay. It was like, it kind of just was like, yep, I'm a fiercely independent woman. Like, this is it. Here I am going to get my baby.
Yeah.
and my flatmate at the time actually picked me up from egg collection. But like, as you know, after egg collection, you're a bit stoned and it's quite hilarious. So that was really weird. And I think the most tricky time is like that. They've collected the eggs, you're waiting for fertilization, and then you're waiting to see, like it's totally literally out of your hands and out of your uterus. You're waiting to see what happens and what continues to grow. And then we had to freeze those embryos anyway because of COVID.
So how many tries did it take to land on the embryo that became Hazel?
Yeah, so we did those two cycles. We froze two. We put one back. It didn't stick. And then we had one in the freezer and we managed to get the approval from ACC. And even though we had the one embryo, I said, I'd like to do two back-to-back. They approved two cycles. So I was like, cool, I want to do two back-to-back cycles and get embryos while I'm young. And so we did a cycle.
Just checking some facts here in the background. Yes. on the phone to make sure we got the story right.
July 2019. So I did my third cycle in July 2020. And that was the cycle that we're out of two COVID lockdowns, and that was the cycle that I decided to, did two back-to-back cycles, and the first one was the one that created Hazel. I've kept like an Excel spreadsheet of, because
I kind of wish we'd done that a bit more, because I like in my head.
They
I'm
do
like,
start oh, to get what? A bit blurry.
Oh, they do. And like my specialist is really awesome. I love her. I want to be in charge of my health journey and my health information because it's my body and it's nobody else's. So I keep my Excel spreadsheet. So that cycle, the cycle three, and that made Hazel, but it was a freeze-all cycle because we were going to go straight into another IVF cycle, which we did.
Oh, that's full on.
Yeah, it was. But it was also awesome because I was like, power.
We're
like,
getting these embryos in the bank.
Yeah. So, Hazel was that third cycle. Then we did the fourth cycle. I did have a fresh transfer then. We made two embryos. I had a fresh transfer and got pregnant. And that was just, I was so elated. I had my home pregnancy tests. I saw the line getting darker and darker. Darker and darker. It was just the best feeling in the whole wide world because I'd had obviously negatives for the two cycles before that, two transfers, and I was just elated. And seeing that line getting darker, I was like, the HCG's rising. And then my blood test came and I think that it was like 39 or something, and I think they like it to be like above 80 at the point that I was at. And they were like, like I was expecting them to say, you're pregnant. Mm. And they were like, so your HCG is only.
All the numbers get quite clinical.
Yeah,
too,
and
don't
I can't
they?
Even actually remember exactly, but it was too low. And so we watched and watched and watched, and it rose, but it rose inconsistently, and then it went up a bit, and then it went down a bit, and then it went up again.
Oh, so your heart's in your mouth the whole time.
It was such a like, you're pregnant. But you're not really pregnant, or like it was, it was just you're kind of pregnant. That was it. Like, you can't actually be kind of pregnant, but in this situation, I was kind of pregnant. Like, my bloods showed that I was pregnant, and they ended up seeing that there was a sac in the uterus, but that pregnancy didn't continue. It wasn't viable. And so that was what they call a biochemical, but I think I ended up having, I was having quite a lot of pain and they were worried that it was ectopic. I ended up having a laparoscopy and DNC, which was a whole another thing, really.
It's quite a painful surgery to recover from, the laparoscopy, where they blow up your belly and go in through your belly button. It's not nice.
Yes, but I'd been used to the recovery because I think by that time I'd had three laparoscopies for endo. So right. I kind of, I knew about that recovery, but sort of in a way. But this was all like emotionally charged with pregnancy loss. But obviously I work at the hospital and so I had immense support from my colleagues and family. But everyone was really beautiful. And then they basically said after that, because that dragged on for like 3 weeks or something of trying to work out whether this was a viable pregnancy, maybe longer than that, maybe more like a month. That was in September, and they said that they wanted me to have a 3-month break to kind of let my hormones.
Yeah, sometimes like you just to sort of body to re-level itself.
Yes.
And
So my HCG came down, and it was fine. But I had to take some months off, which was really annoying. I was so bummed. Yeah, I was bummed. But we've had another transfer in the early December. And that was successful. That was my girl.
Okay. And so when did you get to be excited about that one, given what you'd just been through?
I think it was I haven't got the numbers written down in terms of the HCGs, but it was...
This spreadsheet is detailed.
Yeah. Oh, heck.
It's got the HCG levels in it.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of the pregnancy with Hazel, though, how was that for you? Was it what you expected?
Oh, I was so elated. Like, I was just so... I was so, so stoked. It was anxiety-provoking, and there's a lot... Like, every step brings with it new... anxieties. And for a person that lives with anxiety, like, you've just really got to find coping strategies after after going through like such a massive, well, I felt was a massive journey for IVF cycles and a miscarriage. And I know people do, like, some people do like 15 transfers.
That's the thing, is I don't think you can compare it.
Yeah.
Because you were also going through this.
Yeah. Yeah.
On your own.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So it was. I was elated, to be honest. I was so elated. So obviously the wanting to see the HCGs rising is the first anxiety. Okay, we want to see that it's doubling or more every 48 hours, I think it is.
Yep.
I should know those. Mm-hmm. wanting to see that, and then the next. And I kept having HCG tests, because, like, even after I was seeing my midwife, because I just wanted that reassurance. I think the last one was like 350,000 or something, because I just wanted reassurance. That
sounds like a very convincing number. And I suppose, like, at your work, do you also have access to, you know, can you listen to the baby's heartbeat and whenever you want?
Yeah. Yeah. So I've got like a Doppler. I've got two Dopplers, to be honest. But that's not something that is recommended for a person to do, is to have a Doppler. But as a midwife, it was...
So a Doppler is the thing
that... The fetal heart, sonicade thing that you listen to the baby's heartbeat. But I couldn't have heard it that early on. So the first thing was seeing those HCGs rising. Then I started getting nausea and I was stoked. I was like,
it's a funny thing to celebrate, but it's such a good sign.
5 weeks and I'm feeling nauseous. So good. And then the nausea kind of dissipated around like 9-10 weeks. And then you get to the scan, and I had one extra sneaky scan, and then I got to see the heartbeat. So that was like the next thing. And then the next thing is the 12-week. And like, so yes, I was elated and I was so excited and I was so bonded with the baby from the start. But yeah, there's just new anxieties. You want to get to 20 weeks because then that's the anatomy scan and see that the baby's normal. I really wanted to know the sex. And then you want to get to like 23, 24 weeks because that's like peri-viability, viability. And then you want to get to, you know.
So it's like the anxiety, you tick one off the list and then it just shifts to the next anxiety.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But at the same time, I was like, I need to live in the present. I'm not going to fret about X, Y, and Z. Like, this is where I am now. This is the stage that I'm at. Let's just be present in this stage. Enjoy this stage. Mm. Enjoy, where we're at. And I had this really awesome pregnancy app. I think it's called Pregnancy Plus. And I got to see the baby in real time.
Wow.
In terms, not my baby, but a baby at the gestation I was at. And it was sort of floating in this. Like, it was really cool, and you could
hear
the heartbeat.
Visualize what's going on.
Yeah,
on the inside.
100%. I loved it. I looked at it like multiple times a day because I was like, "That's my baby. That's growing."
Yeah.
I was elated.
Some people think when they start trying for a baby, bam, they'll fall pregnant. But for others, it can take years. They give everything a shot. Surgery, tests, drugs, specialists. Switching up lifestyle choices can help, and this goes for guys too. The journey sperm undertake on their way to fertilize an egg has been likened to a human trying to swim thousands of kilometers. So it's obvious why it's essential to create a healthy environment for sperm production. Menovit is a male fertility supplement specifically formulated to support sperm health and motility. Made with a unique mix of antioxidants, it provides support during the conception journey along with a healthy lifestyle. Menovit is available at leading pharmacies. For more information, head to elevate.co.nz.
Kia ora, Aotearoa, and welcome to The Big Stuff Quiz. I'm your host, Imogen Wells, alongside my assistant, the wonderful
Chris Reid.
Hello, everyone.
Each week, we'll release a new episode to test your wits with two rounds of 10 questions. One potluck round and another that's very loosely themed.
A bit tangential, even.
Such a good word. If you think you're up for the challenge, go and follow our show on your favourite podcast platform. The Big Stuff Quiz is out now.
The Big Stuff Quiz is proudly brought to you by Melbourne. Every bit different.
What about when Hazel did arrive? Did your, and I don't know what stage of COVID lockdown we were when she did arrive, but did your village arrive? Because it's such a big thing to go through at any time. Did you have people around you for the birth, for after the birth, when you're recovering from giving birth?
So we were not in COVID lockdown at the time. We had done two lockdowns, I think. What we were in was the hospital was an RSV, which is like a respiratory virus lockdown. So there were no visitors allowed. But basically, I went into labour early, much earlier than I thought I would at 38 weeks, which is perfectly normal. But I was like, I'm going to stay pregnant till 41 weeks. And I didn't. I had a beautiful labour at home and got to fully dilated pretty quickly within a few hours. And evidently she was too big. She was almost 5 kilos, 10 pound 10. So she wasn't going to fit. We tried.
So for the uninitiated, what's an average baby like?
Like 3.5, 3.4. Yeah. Yeah, about 7 pounds, 7.5 pound. So she was a big chunky girl, which I knew I was going to have because I'm 6'2". But yeah, she just didn't fit. A lot of babies, bigger babies than that, fit out of smaller women. So it was a bit of a surprise. So I ended up, going into the hospital, ending up having an emergency cesarean section. I lost almost 3 litres of blood.
Oh my goodness.
3 litres?
Yeah. I think you've got
how
about
much,
six.
Is that? I was going to say. Yeah. It's not much left
they
in you after
yeah,
that.
They didn't give me a blood transfusion. They gave me an iron infusion so that I could replace my own blood. I went to the HDU, high dependency unit, and Hazel unfortunately came out needing some help with her breathing. So she went to the NICU.
Scary.
So she went to NICU. I went to HDU. We were kind of separated and it was like, oh my gosh, like I have finally met my long-awaited baby. And I had this picture of like what it was going to be like
skin
to be in
to
the
skin.
Water.
Yeah.
Scoop her up out of the water and hold her to my chest and say like, my baby is here. And I envisaged that like fully. And it did not happen. And I got to have her briefly with me in theatre, but she was like not a good colour, not in good condition, floppy ears. And I was like, just take her, sort her. Because I had said I wanted her to come straight to me. And I think they almost just were like, we'll give her to her. Even though, like, because she'll recognise that she really shouldn't be with you and she really shouldn't. So she went and had some help and her blood sugar was low, which is like your energy level, sustaining energy. And it was like I've been through all of this stuff and none of it would have mattered, none of it, like really hugely, if I had just had my long-awaited baby with me. But I didn't. I was like sitting alone in HDU.
So when did you get back together and when did you actually get to go home?
So I went up to see her in NICU and had a cuddle with her, but it was really weird. It was like, yeah, NICU do amazing work, amazing life-saving work, but it was just a bit tricky because I had been asked to come up because she was upset and then they were like, no, don't come up, we're in handover. And I was like, you've told me my baby's upset, like I am coming now. So they pushed me up in the bed and then they were doing handover, but she was crying and she was there and I was here and I was like, this is not a vibe, like I can't just sit here waiting for you. And you know, she's attached to all these monitors, but I wasn't afraid of those because I've seen them all before and helped families with skin to skin with that kind of stuff before. So I was like, I'm not sitting here any longer. So I just scooped her up and was just kind of holding her. Everything was still connected, but I was just holding her and talking to her and sort of just moving her up and down so that she knew that I was there, just so she had motion. They were in a flap about it, me touching her. Anyway, had some lovely skin to skin there, but I got called back down. Like they wanted me to go back down to to HDU. And that was awful, to be honest. It was like, I just said, I need to be with my baby. I knew that that's what she needed.
And but I suppose they're trying to look after you at the same time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So like the delivery suite staff came up and were like, you need to come back down. We need to take your blood. We need to see if you needed a blood transfusion. We need to do your observations. And I was like, this is where I need to be. And I think there is a bit of a gap. Like, I think we could be providing NICU care and maternal care, postpartum care alongside each other. Some countries do that, where the mother and the baby can stay together, but it's uncharted territory. So I went back down, had some bloods and things. I got myself up for a shower. This is like, you know, just a matter of like 3 hours after a cesarean section. But I was like, I need to be with my baby. And I went back up and I just cuddled her and I sang this special song to her that my mum sings to all her grandees. And yeah, and one of my colleagues was up there with me and took some videos and photos. And that was beautiful. I'd expressed about 40 mils of colostrum, which she needed, and she guzzled over that night, which is a lot because babies only take like 1 or 2 mils at a time when they're that little. And then I went and just slept, and I set my alarm for like 6 a.m. in the morning, got up, and I was like, right, I'm going to NICU. I'm ready for skin to skin. And yeah, I arrived. They were like, she's had a good night. We can probably take her off the CPAP once the doctors have done rounds. And I was like, no, we can probably take the CPAP off now because I'm here. So I put her on me and I had her skin to skin pretty much all day. And then that night we got back to the ward. And the next day is when we went to the birth centre. But that night there was an announcement on the TV. 6 o'clock.
Oh, no.
And we were going into, another lockdown. And I was like, this is not happening to my time. This is my time. This is our time. So, yeah, we went into lockdown. So my whole family came, like immediate family, my brothers, their wives, and the kids, the cousins all came, and the donor came to the birth centre. Basically, the birth centre were like, yep, get as many people as you can to visit before midnight because that's when we all got into lockdown. Not as many, but like all the important people.
So they at least got to see you, meet her.
Yes.
But what happens when you do go home? Are you in a bubble with other people?
So my sister-in-law and brother, my brother and sister-in-law kind of joined the bubble with me, and my mum joined a bubble with my other brother and his wife because they were due at the same time with the baby. And so she went there to look after the toddler, and my other brother and wife kind of joined my bubble and were amazing support. Baked the most amazing focaccia, and well, I bought the dough over and then baked it in my house so that the house smelled like focaccia on multiple occasions.
What is it, lockdown, if someone doesn't bake bread?
Exactly. So it was 3 weeks lockdown, and it was tricky because you're right, like the village, it looked a lot different than what I had anticipated. People turned up that I perhaps didn't expect were going to want to send a massive meal box. A couple of midwives from work who I didn't have a heap to do with sent big meal boxes, and three of the obstetricians cooked meals.
Wow. It's amazing to see who shows up for you.
Yeah. It was really amazing. I tried not to overanalyze the solo mum life too much before. I was like, I can't overthink how I'm going to get through and how I'm going to eat and how I'm going to get a shower and how I'm going to make ends meet. I can't overanalyze it, because if you overanalyze everything, you'll never do it. And I think that's probably the same with like just having a baby. Like people putting it off because they're not ready or they don't have enough money saved or whatever. And that's probably not so true. Well, that's not where the fertility world are at, but a lot of people will do that. But actually I just was like, do you know what? I've got to dive in. I've got to suck it and see what it's going to be like. And every day is going to be different. Every day is going to be and like have new challenges. And it totally did. But it's been a ride.
And I guess touching on the practicalities thing of it a little bit, I suppose couples go from having these two incomes and, you know, being able to sort of have a better financial position, and then they drop down to one, so they have to adjust to it. But you're sort of running on this one income. How did you find that from going from being in full-time employment to not?
Yeah. It's hand to mouth. Yeah, it's hand to mouth, and it's pretty full on, to be honest. That's been really hard, but I've had some amazing support from a couple of people, some very generous people in my life that have helped to keep me afloat. But that has been probably the biggest stressor. Not Hazel. She's perfect. She's wonderful and joyful and curious and inquiring and inquisitive and fun and constantly learning and constantly just bringing like such immense joy to my world.
You make me cry. Yeah. Just hearing you talk about how... Yeah.
She's just joy. Perfect. The like joy. She's perfect. There's no problem. The only time she has a wobbly is if I turn the TV off or I don't give her another piece of chocolate. So like those are very real things. Standard.
We like, all know what that
feels
like. Yeah,
when that Netflix series finishes or the block is finished and you've eaten it in one mouthful, like that's heartbreaking. But she is so amazing and she's wonderful in everything I ever dreamed of. It was always her. But it's... Yeah, everything else, all of the other adulting, making ends meet.
It's hard.
Deciding what's the priority to buy, deciding which bill I'm going to leave for a little bit longer. it's adult stuff. Adult stuff is the hard stuff. She is not hard.
And do you ever feel lonely in that, trying to navigate all that stuff on your own?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of that, there's a lot of things that I think, oh, it'd be probably quite good if I had a second brain to just kind of put our ideas together about what we could do. I think we'd probably save a bit better and maybe go on a few more like little holidays and things if I had somebody else. But like, we just got to stick in our rhythm. Like, we just stay in our rhythm. And that is really important to me, is staying in our rhythm. So it's, you know, getting up around a particular time and getting her down to bed at around a particular time. You know, like I've got a few hacks. So it took me 8 months to work out the most important mum hack that I've ever come up with. And that is, I've got my filter coffee. It takes like 10 to 12 minutes to brew it every morning. But it's quite hard to get up and do that first thing in the morning. So I have started making it the night before and putting it in a thermos beside my bed.
Holy that is dedication.
All I've got to do, like it's a true sign of addiction because quite often I'm just thinking about the next morning's brew. But yeah, all I've got to do is just roll over and pour myself a cup of liquid salvation.
Genius.
Liquid salvation.
It's so good. And Hazel knows. She knows what that is. So that's my mum hack. Most important thing. It took me, until she was about 8 months to come up with that. But yeah, it's a juggle. But our rhythm is our rhythm. And I think people probably get a bit annoyed with me sometimes because I'm like, we've got to go home for Hazel's nap because that's my downtime. That's when I get to make the second coffee.
No, you get to do you.
Yeah.
You're in charge here. One thing I did want to ask you about is I know that for a lot of my mum friends, going back to work is a wrench and it's a way up as to what you end up losing in terms of time with your child as well as the cost of childcare. How have you navigated that whole question?
That's been huge. It's been really huge. So, she was only born and I was sort of fretting. Well, I was still pregnant and I was fretting about what I was going to do. And my boss was like, I just want you to enjoy having a baby and we'll talk about this when she's like 10 months old. But you can't really do that because you have to think about childcare and a good centre or carer will have a waiting list. And so I had to be thinking about it beforehand and I was, and I got Hazel on the waiting list really early on, which was only a few months old. But yeah, that's really hard, is knowing that I don't want to work full time because I want to be present for my long awaited baby. I want to be available. I don't want to be missing out on all the cool stuff that she does and she says. I don't want her to be with someone who at that time was effectively a stranger, enjoying all that cool stuff. So I want to just work part-time so she gets an opportunity to build a relationship with someone else and build relationships with little friends. But actually financially, that's not beneficial at all. And in fact, I'm better off not working. So But I'm doing it. I'm doing the part-time thing, and I'm not necessarily benefiting at all financially from doing that. I'm better off being a full-time mum and receiving government supports financially. And what's happened is my boss has been really amazing. My bosses have been really amazing, and I'm kind of in a what we call a flexible working arrangement where I'm working from home, which is kind of unheard of for a midwife, but yeah, and picking up a little bit of clinical work.
Mm. Well, it's great having those employers that support you in that right way.
So much, yeah.
So just wanted to also talk about your lovely donor, Stuart.
Yeah.
What's his involvement in your life sort of as you guys go forward?
Yeah, so he is Hazel's precious Uncle Stuart, and his husband is Uncle Anadu, which has been a bit tricky for her to say as yet, but Adududu.
Oh, cute.
And they've got a beautiful daughter, and they're really starting to, yeah, have a relationship blossom. She's six, so there's a real age difference there. But no, we see a lot of them, and we didn't know how it was going to look. We knew we were happy. Like, he just wanted baby cuddles. That was all he wanted out of it. And it was going to, yeah, unfold. And it has unfolded in a really amazing way. And we see, yeah, we see them more than I see my own family, I think. In fact, like this morning, Hazel had her little baby doll in her front pack, and we were off for a little walk. And I thought, oh, let's wander down to the cafe at the end of the street. And I text them because they quite like that cafe, and just said, we're on our way down. Do you want to meet up? So, yeah.
What a great relationship.
That's so cool. Yeah. And they were like, we're just getting out of bed. Like, we're coming.
We're on our way.
And Hazel, yeah, was so excited when I said, yes. Stoot.
Now, I know you'd like to have more children.
Yeah.
Is that on the cards soonish?
It's another, like, analyses moment. Yeah, so I definitely do want to have another baby. I always wanted to have five kids, and I always imagined having, like, five or six kids. But that was, you know, the homesteading life of, like, a partner and, like, a really amazing job that finances our beautiful homesteading life of, like, homeschooling and home birthing and home baked bread. And so I've scaled that back a bit, and I think two kids is probably, yeah, achievable for me as a solo parent. And initially, when I first had Hazel, I was like, yeah, this is a breeze. I'm having another transfer when she's one, which is the recommendation if you've had a cesarean section, is to wait a year at least. At the very least. And then we hit 6 to 12 months, and I was like, whoa, solids, and just like preparing these beautiful, nutritious, amazing meals for her, and then just having them pitched across the lounge and like very demoralizing. So and then I need to be on the move, and I need to be exploring and checking things out, but I want you to be close to me, but I want you to pick me up, but don't pick me up, put me down, let me explore. Just so full on 6 to 12 months. And I was like, nah, I'm waiting till she's two. So then now we're kind of approaching two, and I'm thinking, I probably need to save a bit more money.
Yeah. Like you said, though, there'll always be a reason,
yes,
not to.
Exactly. Right. And then just in the last 24 hours, I've seen a few newborns, and I'm like, no, I just need to, I need to crack on. Not right this minute, but yeah, I think when she's two. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know quite a few single women who are phenomenal, would like to be parents. Do you have any advice for women who are in your situation and are like, okay, I think the option is we're going to go it alone? Like, what have you learned from your journey that you can pass on to others?
It's just totally immensely worth it. Don't put it off. There are options. Like, you don't necessarily have to have a baby right now. You could just, you know, have a consult with a fertility specialist and just see where things are at with your ovarian reserve. Maybe you can look at having an egg collection. Obviously, embryos are more stable in terms of freezing and thawing and stuff than just eggs, but you don't have to compromise your chance of having a child because of your singleness. So, yeah, there's a lot of steps that you can go on to kind of help increase your chances of ending up with a baby. So,
yeah. So you're kind of saying to other single women, don't let the fact that you don't have a partner stop you.
Yeah.
It is still a wonderful, rewarding,
yeah,
life-changing experience.
But it's so great not having to rely on someone who's unreliable and wake up and, like, I know, like, yeah, just crack on. Crack on if that's what you want to do. And there's actually a huge village of single mums by choice in New Zealand. We've got a Waikato little page that just kind of connects us because we're all immensely busy. So, like, we don't do a lot of catching up, but we're connected. And we all know that we're not alone in our journeys.
Well, an amazing chat, and thank you so much for sharing your story. We are now at the finish line, where we like to ask four questions to all our guests.
Okay.
Excuse me. So I'll start with question one. People love to try and be helpful when you're struggling to conceive / stick their oar in and, you know, give their advice. What's the worst piece of advice someone has given you during the fertility process, or the most helpful piece of advice?
Most helpful piece of advice.
Well, the worst.
Yeah. Well, the worst was definitely people say things like, just relax and it'll happen. Like, it's going to not happen.
That one's been coming up a lot.
We need to have that as a counter in this podcast as to how many times that's come up.
It's a public service announcement. Do not tell a woman trying to conceive to relax.
Yeah.
End of.
It's not going to work. It's not going to work. If it hasn't worked to just have sex and have a baby, then saying just like, it's actually such a conscious conception. So that's one thing. But the one person who said, oh, well, you know, it's designed for two parents because it's really hard.
Oh, that's helpful.
Yeah, thanks so much.
I know that was a really hard, another person sort of insinuated that maybe I wasn't praying hard enough for a husband. Yeah.
So how do you pray harder? What would you say to, what's maybe the number one piece of advice that you'd give to someone at the start of this journey? Maybe something that you wish that you had known when you got started.
Probably two things. How much money I had before and how much time I had before. So it's probably not directly related to the fertility journey, but I wish that I had like a little snapshot into my future of how constrained I was going to feel in terms of finances and time.
You just don't know what you don't know.
Yes, So now I just have like no procrastination in my, like, it just doesn't even exist in my life.
Well, I think we can safely say a woman who puts a thermos of coffee beside her bed at nighttime is the picture of organisation.
Yeah, but then if you saw my house, you'd be like, whoa, it's a bomb site. But, like, there's rhythms. Yeah, so I think make the most of the time that you have. You've got space and you've got time, and there are things that you can do to enjoy your life and have fulfilment that will be really difficult to do once you do have children. And I know that can be quite offensive when people say things like that, like, oh, well, you just wait until blah, 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 blah. But, yeah, just there are things that you can do, and there's a lot of, you know, freedom that childlessness gives you, but that's not to discount the, you know, the people that are waiting for their babies.
So question three is about what advice would you give to those people supporting someone going through the infertility process? Like, how would you tell them they could best help?
I think you show up, offer, send a text, check in, see how people are doing. I think it is very isolating to do fertility treatment by yourself and not have another brain to be kind of bouncing ideas off of or processing a particular test result that's come in. I was really like conscious of just maintaining a stable footing and not getting caught up in other people's disappointment or other people's excitement about whatever stage of the situation I was at. So I was like really independent in that respect. But I think most people would enjoy people checking in, just flicking a text, just saying, hey, I'm thinking of you. I know, like trying to remember. And if you're shit at remembering, just like making note in your diary.
Keep a spreadsheet.
if your friend's going through fertility treatment, make it, you know, she's said she's got egg collection on this date. make a note in your diary and, you know, the night before, flick them a text. And
that's a great point, because people's lives do get busy and they don't mean to not check in.
Yes, but life. Just consciously making
in your
effort.
Situation, I guess, that level of connection and care, you don't want that to end when the baby arrives.
Yeah.
You almost, that's when you need it even more, right? Yeah, you need people to show up in your village.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I think people also forget, they either forget, they have children of their own, they grow up, and then they forget how immensely helpful it is if someone just offers to drop off some muffins or sends a text to ask how you are or offers to come and vacuum. Like, a friend came and vacuumed when Hazel was little. She was too little for me to really want to be apart from her, but I just really needed to vacuum. You know, just those little things that might take someone 20 minutes or half an hour just feel like immense nuggets of gold to any mum, but a solo mum that is trying to juggle everything. So I think just think about those little things that you can do, because they feel like $1 million.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And people like doing practical things too, don't you? Feeling useful. So question four, obviously so much of this process can be heartbreaking, but some of it can be awkward too, sometimes even funny. Have you had any memorable funny moments through your churning?
The funniest memory for people looking in was me being in labour and, being the fiercely independent person that I am. I had everything kind of perfectly organised and orchestrated. So there was going to be, there was a pool, and I needed, it had like a califont to heat the water that had to be plumbed into my garden hose. I'd got my brother over to set that all up. But there was like a bit of, like, once I was in labour, there was a bit of sort of switcheroo-y tinkering that needed to happen. So my water's broke, and I was like, damn it, oh well. And so I was just on full organization mode. We had to reorganize the lounge so that there was space for the pool, so we had to take one of the couches out to the garage. I was just a little bit of a type A personality. Like, just very...
And this is while you're fully dilated.
Yeah, fully dilated, just walking around the house. So, like, looking in, those were probably some, I mean, I tend to not have much of a filter, and so there are moments of hilarity and awkwardness peppered through the whole thing. Anyone who knows me knows that. But probably looking in, that could have been one of the most comical times was, me prepping my house. For birth.
Fully dilated. Jessica, thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you. And a big shout out to all the solo parents out there, not just the solo mums, as well as solo dads and those. But thanks so much for telling your story. We really appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Human Race, a podcast from Wabi Sabi Media and Stuff.
Follow the show on Apple, Spotify, or any other podcast app.
And please leave a review. It helps other people discover this important content.
You can also listen at stuff.co.nz/thehumanrace.
We'd also love to hear from you. Email thehumanrace@stuff.co.nz and follow us at facebook.com/thehumanracenz or on Insta @thehumanracenz.
The Human Race was produced by me, Dan Higgins.
And me, Nadine Higgins.
Audio editing and mixing by John Ropeha.
The associate producer was Jen Black.
And executive producer was Chris Reed.
Thanks very much for listening.
That was The Human Race, which was proudly brought to you by Elevit. Support babies' healthy development at every stage.
Always read the label, follow the directions for use. Vitamin and mineral supplements are not a substitute for a balanced diet. If you have a baby with a neurotube defect or spina bifida, seek specific medical advice. Bayer New Zealand Limited, Auckland.
If you don't have time to read the in-depth stories, or you just prefer to listen instead, The Long Read from Stuff is the podcast for you. Each week we showcase one of our excellent pieces of journalism, telling important or entertaining stories from the world of crime, sport, history, culture, and more. You also get to hear from the journalists themselves about how they uncovered the story and how it came to life. So, for your weekly dose of long-form journalism, beautifully read, subscribe to The Long Read from Stuff wherever you get your podcasts.